Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street here on member-supported Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. A bit later in today's show, we'll visit with J.O. and try to give you all the information that you need when it comes to the ongoing Medicare enrollment process. But first, it's our monthly philosophical currents discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. There's our man, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a philosophy professor at the University of North Dakota and host of the public radio show that we air right here on Prairie Public, Why? Philosophical discussions about everyday life, where he explores how philosophical ideas intersect with daily life and current events. And our segment here we call Philosophical Currents. Jack, welcome back to Main Street.
Still standing and happy to be here.
All right, Jack, we're going to talk about connection here, and essentially the philosophy of community and connection, the significance of human connection in a digital age. And as we start this conversation, I go back to this conversation I had with my kids, remarking that, hey, I heard this architect talk about design of homes and how homes today don't have front porches designed anymore. And how sad is that? Because now you just push the button, you go in your garage, you don't wave to your neighbor, and you're inside. Well, Jack, we have this digital platform now we know all about, which our kids say that fosters genuine human connection. Or does it lack in-depth connection, Jack? I want to start right there. What do you think?
Well, it's funny that you bring that up, because we had two episodes of Why Radio, one on philosophy of architecture that talked about exactly this, the way that architecture makes things accessible for community gatherings, and then one on the urbanization of happiness, how cities are constructed. And I think we forget how important our physical space is to how we relate to one another. Being in a confined space makes us suspicious of other people. Being in an enlarged space makes us feel isolated or alone. Not being able to see the exits makes us feel trapped, but seeing too many exits makes us feel overwhelmed. These ideas that our physicality sets up our mood, which then allows us to be open or close to other people, is very, very powerful. And what happens with the digital environment is that space disappears. That space becomes irrelevant. Maybe your room is relevant. Maybe you have a lot of stuff on your desk and you feel chaotic, or the camera, when you're talking to someone on FaceTime, you can't really see them. And so you're staring at your own image while you're talking, which is very common these days. There are physical impacts. And I think when the digital erases the commonality, then we're all floating in space. And in floating in space, we lose orientation. And we're at a disadvantage automatically just from that.
So Jack, define for us, let's step back a little bit, these core elements that define human connection. And then I want to ask you, in your view, how these have changed because of digital technology.
Well, Aristotle famously said, man is the political animal. And what he means by that is that we are a pack animal. We are designed to be social, to be with other people. And we are at our best when we're collective in that sense. And we're at worst when we're isolated. We are dependent animals. A philosopher named Alistair MacIntyre used the phrase rational dependent animals. We need one another at key elements in our lives. We need one another at birth. We need one another growing up. We need one another when we're elderly and we're more dependent on someone else for help. One of my wife's aunts has very bad arthritis and she can't open bottles and needs help, which is particularly bad because she's in Asheville, North Carolina, and they don't have running water right now. And so her survival depends on whether or not she can open a bottle of water. By being political animals, it means that we are incomplete without other people. How we see one another and how we see ourselves is filtered the same way. I am right now the Jack that Craig sees, but I'm also the Jack that Prairie Public listeners hear, and I'm the Jack that has this reputation. When I turn off the microphone and I'm Jack the dad, I'm very, very different. And when I'm Jack the husband, I'm very, very different. I'm Jack the teacher, I'm very, very different. What it means to be Jack is very much defined by who we are at any one moment in relation to other people. And we define ourselves in terms of how we see ourselves through other people.
Has digital communication, Jack, improved our sense of community after these things that maybe I talked about earlier, architects did to our homes that kind of prevented us from welcoming our neighbors, having big fences in our yard, not talking to our friends. Has digital things helped us?
I'm really torn because there are times when I really feel like the digital platforms has made us more lonely, have made us more isolated. There are people who, when they are anonymous online, act out in ways that they would never act out while people were watching, while their name was associated to it. So there is a lot of negativity. At the same time, I watched my daughter during the pandemic and how she was connected to her friends 24 hours a day. She would do her homework and FaceTime was on in the background. She met all sorts of people on these discussion boards and on these social networks. And some of her closest friends now are people that she was friends with for 18 months before she actually met face-to-face. So on the one hand, there is this element of isolation and this element of solitude. On the other hand, there is this powerful social connection that knows no geographical bounds, that you can have friends in Palestine, you can have friends in Zimbabwe, you can have friends in Italy, you can have friends all over the place and not leave your living room. And so I wonder if the question is whether or not you are raised in this environment. If you are raised where you take for granted the digital connections, then you can make the most of it. But if you're my age and all of this is fairly new and it's overwhelming and you only know how to use 10 or 15% of your phone in the first place, then all of a sudden it can be very, very isolated. One of the flip sides of the relational aspect of human beings is how much control we have over our environment. And one of the things that I think makes it hard to have a blanket statement about the digital world is different people have different senses of control over the digital world. Some people don't know how to use FaceTime, and other people can do these incredible complicated filters and all these things and make it a pleasure and a joy and a joke anytime you interact with anybody.
What about gender and digital communications, Jack? And I think that I've visited with you before about the story of my mom and dad. After retirement, my mom was in every social group known to Riverton, Wyoming, every one of them, and had something to do every single day. And my dad, having worked two jobs all of his life, of course, was not. Now, here comes the digital world. Perhaps he could have used that as a launch to become more socially connected to someone, maybe somewhere else. Is there a difference in gender on how we use digital connections to develop community that we're aware of?
I think there is. And I think that in this sense, when we focus on gender, we actually can see two new sets of negatives. The first, as is well known, is that men, as a general rule, are not proactive about social activity. Men, as a general rule, don't make the plans in heterosexual couples. The wife is making the plans. The wife is arranging for dinners with friends. Men tag along. And because men have not been educated to be proactive, it's much harder for men to find a vehicle for them to meet other people. There are things like fantasy football. There's things like gaming platforms and stuff like that. So I don't want to overgeneralize, but as especially for, again, your and my generation, that lack of proactivity makes it very, very hard for men to reach out and find new people. And they don't have their partners. They don't have their wives making the arrangements for them. And so there's a real sense of loneliness amongst middle-aged men, in particular men in their 30s and up. There's a sense of isolation and sadness and a real epidemic of loneliness that needs to be addressed, particularly among men. At the same time, women who are usually much more proactive are much more susceptible to attack online. There's a lot of anti-women stuff online. Lots of women gamers report horrendous behavior from male gamers, and that when you identify yourself as a woman online, you are subject to all sorts of constant come-ons and insults and sexual requests. That doesn't happen in book clubs, right? That doesn't happen in community environment. Again, we go back to that question. I ask my students all the time, if you're in a social network I'll use MySpace because that was the original one. If you use a social network where you're completely anonymous and no one can tie it to your name and you can act however you want, and you compare it to a social network like Facebook, where you or your name, your face, your whole community is watching, which is the real you? Are you the real you when you are anonymous, free from consequences? Or are you the real you when your reputation and where expectations guide you? And I don't have an answer for that, but it does illustrate that tension in the digital environment, because it is very, very easy to be able to act in a way that is completely non-accountable and completely free of any kind of consequences. At the same time, when you do identify yourself, your name, your face, it's accessible to the whole world. And so all of a sudden your audience ceases to be that local group and starts to be everyone who has access to the internet in the world. And then if you make a mistake, if you fall on your face, if you make a bad joke, if you use the wrong word, you are at risk of being taken out of context and really having your life destroyed. And so on the one hand, again, the digital environment is something of incredible potential and incredible excitement and incredible connection. On the other hand, with that potential excitement and connection comes danger, comes lack of control, and comes distortion of who you are. I'm always really reluctant to answer a question like this with just one answer. The internet is not just one thing. The digital world is many, many, many things at once. And trying to navigate them, avoid the negatives, and pursue the positives, that requires skill, that requires dexterity, and that requires a lifetime of education that our kids and grandkids have, the older people not as much.
As always, I'm enjoying my conversation with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He's a philosophy professor at the University of North Dakota. And in this edition of Philosophical Currents, we're talking about the philosophy of community and connection and exploring the significance of human connection in a digital age. Jack, I pay for a version of ChatGPT that has some features that I think that others who don't pay for ChatGPT have yet. And the version that I pay for has this thing that I can interact with exactly like I am interacting with you right now. In fact, I could have this exact interview with ChatGPT with the audio, ChatGPT speaking to me. You and I are having this interview. I'm visiting with you. You are visiting with me. And then I'm going to walk away into my life. Am I a worse person if it was with ChatGPT, or a better person? Because now I was talking with somebody who knows everything, and Jack only knows quite a bit, but he only knows what he knows. Where's the lines there that we really need to be thinking about relative to our interactions?
I don't know that I like the term worse or better in this context.
When I said the question, I was worried that I didn't say exactly that. But proceed, sure.
I would rephrase it and ask, am I a healthier person, fulfilled person? It is certainly true that AI has access to tons of information, although one of the problems with AI is that AI doesn't know the difference between truth and falsity. And so it gives answers that may be accurate or may be inaccurate with the same amount of certitude. The way that the language acquisition model works, it looks at the probability of the next word. It gets really complicated really quickly, and I only know like a fingernail's sketch of it. But basically, the short version is that artificial intelligence language models are looking at all of the different models and asking, what is the most likely next word? And that's what I'm going to put on. And so when it comes to answering your questions or answering your or giving you an analysis for something, it could be true. It might not be true. The AI doesn't know the difference.
Empathy comes in, right? Because you and I see each other, we hear each other, and you respond to some things perhaps that you're seeing in addition to what you are hearing, the exact combination of letters that I'm using a statistical model to predict what's next, as you were talking about.
Empathy is incredibly important here, because empathy is what's required for you and I to respect one another while we're talking. The upcoming episode of Wired Radio, we're looking at the feeling of touch. We're looking at the sense of touch. And one of the things that comes up over and over again is that what I'm touching you, you're touching me. There's a dual directionality to the axis of touch. And with artificial intelligence, it doesn't work that way. You may be touching the artificial intelligence, but it's not touching you. It has no interaction with you. It's completely artificial.
I might be thinking that it's touching me, but in reality, sure.
Exactly right. And so really the question is, are you healthy if all of your interactions are in a puppet show? Are you healthy if all of your interactions are artificial or fictional or completely disconnected from who you are as a person? ChatGPT is an amazing tool and it has done wonderful things for us, and it can also be really fun in a lot of respects. At the same time, there is something that we get from real conversation. There's something we get from looking people in the eye. There's something we get by hearing someone cough or having to wait until the other person is done speaking before we speak. There's something about anticipating how I answer questions. I mean, one of the things that you and I have been learning to do since you've taken over Philosophical Currents is we've been learning how to ask and answer questions in a way that the other person will find natural. That's the nice thing about being co-hosts, if you can use that term, is I want to answer a way that inspires the best out of you, and you want to ask and answer things in a way that inspires the best out of me. AI doesn't work that way. And so even in the mere act of conversation, we are together in a community in a way that the artificial intelligence could never replicate, because we are trying to figure each other out and live in the same intellectual universe in a way that computers can't replicate.
Have you stepped back, Jack, to think about 5 years from now or 10 years from now, how the digital world with all of these devices that are coming to us almost each and every day, Siri now is getting some of those qualities that I was talking about, I believe, with that ChatGPT has that I experienced. Have you contemplated what human connection is going to become?
I'm torn by that answer, because one of the very first things I ever published was a conversation about computers and where they were going to take us. And I don't know that one can predict these things, except that human beings are going to stay human beings, and that whatever happens digitally, they're always going to be the people who pull us back together just as the technology pulls us apart. There are, of course, people who love vinyl now. In a world in which Apple Music gives you access to every single musical track ever recorded, there are still people who want to put on a vinyl record and listen for 20 minutes and flip it over because it slows them down.
And look at the cover art in their hands, by the way.
Exactly right. And read the text on the back. And as much as video games are all the rage and a huge business and people are immersed in video game worlds, there's still board game nights at many, many coffee shops around the country and around the world. There's still trivia nights. My best friend goes to trivia night religiously every week at a bar where they, you know, they can play Trivia Crack on the phone, but all those people instead go to do it in person. And so I think there's always going to be a push and pull. And I actually think that the bigger impact on our relationship with digital life is going to be what happens in the upcoming election. It's going to be what happens with environmental disasters and how safe we feel outside. It's going to be things like gun violence and all of that sort of stuff. I think we tend to regard the digital world as the moving force in our society, and that we are responding to digital innovation as if digital innovation defines our environment, when in fact, digital innovation is always a response to and a mediating factor in our environment. And so the more safe we feel outside, the less we're going to need those digital items. The more safe we feel about the future, the more we can take these digital things less seriously. But the less control we feel, the more agoraphobic we feel, the more sense that we don't trust our neighbor, that's going to affect things even much more than the technology. I say over and over again, in almost every public talk I give, I always say the same thing. The Western tradition, in the story that it tells itself, begins with the first question that humanity asks God, and that is, am I my brother's keeper? Digital world is not my brother. Digital world is not my sibling. Digital world is something else. And so our relationship to the digital world is going to depend entirely on how we feel about other people. I don't think it's the other way around. I don't think how we feel about people is a response to the digital environment. I think how we feel about the digital environment is a response to how we feel with the people who we see when we walk down the street.
I think there are ways that we all can use technology to support human connection rather than allowing it to replace it or diminish it. I would assume you would agree with that, Jack.
With absolute certainty.
Jack, are there folks who might be listening who have fallen into, and I'll say, the trap of a primary digital connection that are worried that they can't, in a sense, re-enter the community space in person?
Well, let me first say that there are people for whom the digital environment is life-saving. People who are homebound, people who are rural and have no one to talk to for 20 miles in any direction, people who have contagious diseases, people who need remote work because they can't get work near them. Again, I want to remind us that the digital world isn't one thing. And there's a lot of liberating aspects of the digital world that we have to acknowledge. At the same time, human beings are creatures that become addicted, and human beings are creatures that become habituated to things that are often self-destructive. And so a lot of our relationship with the digital world has to do with our self-awareness. How much is too much? How much is harmful? At what point is looking at our phone connecting with our friends, and how much is it just a dopamine hit that you need over and over and over and over again? And there are absolutely people who are trapped in that cycle. And there are absolutely people who would rather have digital relationships, digital sexual relationships, digital conversations, as opposed to being in person. And when you choose digital over real people, I think that that is a red flag at least, and a real danger at best. And that's why I think there's a difference between having a conversation with ChatGPT online while you're playing a video game and having a conversation with a real person who's playing the video game with you. There's nothing wrong or unhealthy about having a group of friends who play Fortnite once a week and then get to laugh and tell jokes and talk to one another, but playing it only by yourself without any other human contact, I think that that's really risky, and most people can't handle it and still be healthy.
Meta now, Jack, allows us, as we wrap up, to put on some virtual reality headsets, if you will, and go sit in the, air quotes here, first row at an NBA game instead of going to the NBA game.
In a certain sense, that is less than ideal. Would I like to sit next to Spike Lee as he abuses the players? Absolutely. Would I love the opportunity in a major league game to catch the baseball that just was a home run? Absolutely. Would I like the hot dogs and the popcorn and the peanuts and sit next to people who are amazing fans and have that joint experience? Absolutely. But, you know, a ticket to Yankee Stadium can cost $500, $750. Most people can't afford that. You also have to be in the Bronx in New York City to go to Yankee Stadium. There's no professional baseball team. There's no professional football team in North Dakota. And so to be able to put on a headset and really be immersed in a game, assuming the camera operator knows what they're doing, assuming you can really see the game player, that's an unbelievable thing. The question is, can you do that with friends as well? Can you put on 5, 7, 10 headsets, everyone in their own room, and talk to each other while you're watching the game the way that you would sit in your living room, have some buffalo wings, and watch the game? If you can reproduce that, I think that it is a tremendous gift to humanity. If you can't, if watching the game means being alone and lacking all other sensation, then I think that it's very dangerous.
I've told my kids for years we're going to be able to go to a concert, my wife and I on our couch, you on your couches, watch, say, Taylor Swift, and look at each other and talk about it and that technology is coming someday. But when it comes, Jack, we'll have to have another discussion about that.
And we'll be able to watch Taylor Swift from 20 feet away, as opposed to from the top bleachers that where basically you're looking at her on a video screen anyway.
Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, he's a philosophy professor at the University of North Dakota. He hosts the public radio show right here on Prairie Public, Why? Philosophical discussions about everyday life. And he joins me once a month for Philosophical Currents. Jack, it's always a great pleasure.
I love this. It's always so much fun. Thank you so much, Craig. When he comes home, he's relaxed with
pet. He always got a gift for me. After the break, Medicare open enrollment. That's next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Boucher, Realtor with Hatch Realty, brokered by Real. Serving home buyers and sellers in the Fargo-Moorhead Metro, Grand Forks, Bismarck, Mandan, and Detroit Lakes area. Josh can be reached at 701-369-4839 or hatchrealty.com.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The 2024 Medicare open enrollment period will run, or is running, from October 15th through December 7th. And this, is, of course, is the annual window when beneficiaries can make changes to their Medicare coverage for next year. Here to discuss is my guest here on Main Street, J.O. He's the author of Maximize Your Medicare and is an education fellow at the Alliance for Lifetime Income, a nonprofit that educates the public about the value of guaranteed lifetime income during retirement, which includes smart Medicare planning. Jay, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Main Street.
It's my privilege. Thank you for having me today.
Jay, let's begin with what you perceive to be the most significant changes for Medicare beneficiaries next year that folks should be aware of as they're planning right now.
As every year, that one of my central recommendations is always to check your existing configurations, because all of the plans, and in 2025, that is especially true for prescription drug plans, otherwise known as Part D, standalone drug plans, as well as Medicare Advantage plans, which is also known as Part C, which combine health benefits and many times with prescription drug benefits. Big changes in 2025 resulting from a complicated system. We have 66 million and counting. Peak 65 is here into the Medicare system. And then in addition to that, the Inflation Reduction Act is notably changing the way that prescription drug benefits are working next year.
It just amazes me this time of year how many ads we begin to see on television, hear on radio. How do you get information that's best for you?
I am running a firm with a Medicare enrollment and guidance department. So you'll understand that I'll have certain biases along the way here. But every location, every state has something called SHIP, which is a government-sponsored kind of counselors. And depending on your location, you may be able to set up appointments to speak to individuals about Medicare specifically. Now, they are not agents. They are not licensed to give insurance guidance. That said, they can be a valuable information resource. In your introduction, you correctly pointed out that my book, Maximize Your Medicare, is there for people to get a very good, highly detailed setup, explanation, if you will, about how Medicare works and many of the common pitfalls and combinations that a household can face. These two are largely the way that I would do it. That said, calling a carrier is not going to be wrong. I don't want to say that by any means that a carrier, if you called a carrier, that they will tell you wrongful information. I find that almost impossible to believe because we are so highly regulated by federal, state, and carriers all simultaneously. It is more about asking the right questions. It is more about getting the critical piece of information required to make a decision.
I want to give Jay that contact information here in North Dakota for listeners who are interested. It's insurance.nd.gov/SHIC, S-H-I-C hyphen Medicare. And that is the State Health Insurance Counseling Program. It can also be called at 888
575-6611. Jay, you steered me towards a USA Today report that mentioned that 2 million seniors will actually lose their current Medicare plans. Why is that happening, and what should seniors impacted do?
Well, the causes, there are many different causes, but what I would say is generally prescription drug plans are complicated. It is a very complicated combination of the prescriptions that you take, the pharmacies that are preferred pharmacies, and then all of the different discounts that are behind the scenes, Medicare, inside of Medicare. The result of that has created a situation where many carriers have left the marketplace entirely. To give you an example, in North Dakota in 2024, there are 21 prescription drug plans, and in 2025, there are 14. So if I told you a third of the competition has left the marketplace entirely, you know, I just tell people, use your common sense on any commercial matter, on any business matter. If one third of the sellers have left, it tells you that changes, something is stressing the sellers and the marketplace as a whole. The same thing can be said about Medicare Advantage. The number of plans has actually increased, but the reality is you'll want to check every single detail. And the reason is that we try to help people avoid the situation where you go to the doctor and find out after the fact that the doctor doesn't take that particular Medicare Advantage plan. That's an outcome we're trying to help people avoid, because then you may be responsible for in the entirety of the cost in extreme situations, or higher costs than would have otherwise been necessary.
Jay, can you maybe give us a little tutorial here, especially someone like me who's not of Medicare age, and who, quite frankly, a lot of this is almost foreign at this point in my life. Certainly other seniors understand this better than I do, but clarify the differences, if you will, between Medicare Parts A, B, and D, and how they compare to, let's say, Medigap and Medicare Advantage. Would you please?
So sure. The way that I describe Medicare Part A, B, and D, which is the prescription drug program, is kind of like a chassis to a car. It is a very good chassis. It is a very inexpensive chassis relative to the full sticker price if you had to buy a plan that was under the ACA compliant plans. That said, the parts are complicated. Part A has to deal with inpatient hospitalization. Inpatient hospitalization. From there, there is an deductible. And one of the challenges of Medicare is when people look at deductibles, they think that's a once a year cost. That is not the case for Medicare Part A. It is actually once per benefit period, and the way that I explain it in my book is that you can think of benefit period as medical event. So if you have a left knee replacement in January and a right elbow replacement in June, those are two different benefit periods, two different medical events, two different deductibles. And so it becomes more complicated. One of the things about Medicare is that the language may look similar to your employer-sponsored plan, for example. It actually works differently, and that does make it more complicated. Part B is medical, which is generally what I would call services. So this means office visits, the doctor, blood exam, MRI. And these you have to pay for. There are enrollment windows, and we can discuss that later if you'd like. And what happens there is once you have the monthly deductible, which can vary based on your income. And then on top of that, there's an annual deductible. And from once you meet it, you're responsible for 20% of the Medicare approved charge, which is basically what I call a list of MSRPs, if you will, based on your location and the cost index and the service that you receive. You're responsible for 20% of that. So that, generally speaking, as a starting point, describe Part A and Part B. Part D is the prescription drug program, and that is you can have prescription drug benefits from a VA, for example, or other credible coverage. It's a technical term called credible coverage. But these describe the Medicare plans where your prescriptions are covered. You need to have evidence of having prescription drug plans. Otherwise, you would face a penalty, and a penalty which is permanent, meaning that it never ends throughout your lifetime.
It's kind of scary. Jay, what is Medigap then?
So I called Medigap, or I called Original Medicare, the three parts that I just discussed, as a good chassis to a car. It's not a perfect chassis. The car doesn't have an annual out-of-pocket limit, meaning if you went to the doctor and you went every single day, three times a day, you would continue to pay 20% in theory. As I like to say in public, 20% of $1 trillion is still $200 billion. So there's no cap. Medigap effectively pays for the things that Original Medicare does not. So in most cases, these are plans lettered A through N, and they all cover, for example, elements of Part A and Part B that I just discussed, where you would normally be responsible. Medigap plus Medicare would cover and pay for it. You would still need to be responsible for the Part B deductible, and we do not yet know what the 2025 figures will be. That is announced annually. We would expect that any day now. Medicare Advantage is a very separate set of plans, and this is normally the source of all of the advertisements mail that you will receive, which is their package managed care plans, where the benefits of Part A, Part B, and prescription drugs in most cases will be combined into one card, one plan. And there you may or may not pay a premium. And then you have to deal with the fact that there are networks involved, and then that all of the moving parts can change annually. They are very fundamentally different setups, and I try to spend a lot of time to try to clarify the choice that people are making between Medigap and Medicare Advantage.
We are enjoying our conversation with Jay O. He's the author of Maximize Your Medicare and is an education fellow at the Alliance for Lifetime Income, a nonprofit that educates the public about the value of guaranteed lifetime income during retirement, which includes smart Medicare planning. Jay, for me, who is somebody who is a couple years away yet from Medicare, are there any decisions I need to be making now relative to how my health care will proceed once I turn 65?
It's a great question. In an ideal world, I tell persons that the ideal time to reach out to us, and I have a newsletter called Jay's Corner, and it's J-O, my first and last name, .substack.com, which is to approach us 2 years at least, just maybe a little bit more than that, 2 to 3 years. And the reason is I made reference to it earlier, which is depending on your household income, it is possible that you pay more for both Part B and Part D when you become Medicare eligible. That is entirely possible. And part of the reason that I'm involved with the Alliance for Lifetime Income is because there are so many moving parts under retirement and as people grow older that the financial differences amongst the choices that people make between those people who have planned carefully and those who do not, then, as you probably know, you'll look on your credit card bill and you find out you've been charged for a subscription that you meant to cancel. You know, being blindsided feels like it's like 10 times more expensive. This can happen when people become Medicare eligible. This happens literally in every location that we deal with at various times throughout the year, because these are income tax related premiums. So that if that means that if your income is high, then you could be charged a higher Part B and higher Part D premium.
Jane, this is probably a difficult question for you to answer, but for someone who wants to plan, generally speaking, as a percentage of income, what should we plan for Medicare spending as we age? And does that percentage increase as we get older? Does it stay about the same? Does it fall?
We could literally have hours of conversation around this single topic. what I would say is the following, is that Medicare is purely democratic, meaning that a person with very limited financial resource can access the same plan as someone with many billions of dollars. So the question is really, what access do you require? And you have, as an individual, better information about that specific fact, that set of facts. You know your family history. You know your own specific medical history. You know the way that you tolerate uncertainty. And from there, right, the allocation that you originally ask will vary, you know, quite a great deal. Even from, I like to point out, your twin brother living just across the state line with every other fact the same, their results can be, and the decisions they make could, you know, that could not be the same, and they could not be the same and be very, very rational in both instances. That is entirely possible. That all said, the issue is that Medicare doesn't cover certain things. For example, Medicare is not intended to be long-term care. To be candid with you, we see a lot of headlines from a variety of sources, whether that be your brokerage firms, insurance companies, think tanks, that have some eye-popping numbers as far as here's how much you need to have today in order to, you know, pay for health care, you know, throughout the rest of your life. But I'm not as alarmist as all of that, to be candid. And the reason is that the simple analogy I heard once is, well, we know we're going to pay for X number of dollars of food. That doesn't mean you need that entire X dollars today.
Jay, answer this question. What's the biggest mistake that people make that either A, costs them a lot more money than it should have, or B, really doesn't connect the medical assistance, the medical health care, the health care they need?
The biggest mistake is preparing late. And you asked me rightly, when should I start to learn the language of Medicare? The issue here is that a lot of people have their health insurance benefits provided by an employer. And as a result, you know, they've had one or two choices, meaning one or two different plans at most. Most of the time, you don't have a choice. This is your plan. These are the benefits. The issue with Medicare is all of a sudden, your rights, your options explode in number. The language works slightly differently.
Our guest has been Jay Oh. He's the author of Maximize Your Medicare. He's an education fellow at the Alliance for Lifetime Income. It's a nonprofit that educates the public about the value of guaranteed income during retirement. Of course, that includes smart Medicare planning. You can connect with Jay Oh and get more information on healthcare savings, Medicare, and more at MaximizeYourMedicare.com. Jay, it's been a pleasure. And again, give us enrollment windows that we really need to be conscious of as we close today.
October 15th through December 7th is the Medicare annual election period. You have the unrestricted right to change your Part D plan or change your Medicare Advantage plan. You can't have them both. One will auto-eject the other. So you need to, that said, you can change as many times as you want up through midnight of December 7th. The last one you choose will be in effect for January 1st. For people who are already Medicare Advantage plan members, you'll have an additional window that begins in the first quarter of 2025. And for those people who have been confused or they may have changed their mind, they want to go from Medicare Advantage to Medigap, the time to consider that is now, so that you can first be approved by Medigap and then add a standalone prescription plan, what I call Part D, so that you can have the safety features that you want. And those options will vary greatly. The price points will vary greatly. Your access for price discovery can differ depending on your location and the carriers that are available in where you live.
Jay, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining us on Main Street.
It's been my privilege. Thank you for having me.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 4th. The Oliver family settled near Central Dakota Territory in the 1880s. Large game was disappearing, but wildfowl remained plentiful. While it was easy to shoot most wildfowl, getting close enough to wary cranes was challenging, even when they landed to feed. From September through early November, whooping and sandhill cranes migrated south through Dakota. One day, three white cranes descended into the Oliver cornfield. Mr. Oliver and his son took aim, killing one mature bird and wounding a young one. Young Oliver tied its legs and took it home. The surviving parent flew back and forth for 3 days, calling for its mate and young one. The family decided not to roast the young crane, along with its father. With only a slight wing wound, it was placed in the hen house until it was fit to fly. One morning, it was let out into the yard, where it walked around eating like the chickens. Many cranes had not yet migrated south and circled the farm for over an hour while the young crane tried to call them down. The young crane made no effort to join them and stayed with the Olivers for 3 years. The crane grew tall, awkward, and gangly, resembling the neighbor boy Bill, and was thus named. Bill could fly, but preferred long walks along the roads and creek with the Olivers, making a guttural noise as if talking. He especially enjoyed walking and talking with Mr. Oliver each evening. Sometimes, while the family worked in the fields, large flocks of sandhill cranes landed and danced. Mr. Oliver would spread his arms and imitate them, saying, "Well, Billy, let's dance." Bill would spread his wings and skip around Mr. Oliver, sometimes jumping over him. One night, Bill didn't return home, and the family grew worried, searching ponds and sloughs for miles. After 2 weeks, they heard him trumpeting from afar. He descended joyfully and landed, walking around and talking loudly, as if announcing his pleasure at being home. In winter, Bill stayed in the henhouse to keep warm. The next fall, Bill took off again, returning with two white cranes. He tried all day to introduce them to his human family, but they kept their distance and eventually flew away. Later, while walking up the creek to feed in a small pond, Bill encountered a boy who threw a rock and knocked him out. The boy brought Bill to the Olivers, who shut him in the henhouse to recover, but Bill was gone the next morning. The Olivers searched everywhere for days but found no sign of him. 2 years later, they learned what had happened. A stranger from the east had come hunting along the creek and shot Bill when he approached. The Olivers had no doubt that Bill was heading home to them again. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Elise Erdrich. I'm Ann Alquist.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Stay connected with Prairie Public even when you're not listening or watching. Sign up for our e-newsletters at prairiepublic.org. Read Do You Know Dak? Dave Thompson's fun, funny, informative, and sometimes poignant recalls from his decades covering North Dakota news and politics, as well as insights into the political moment we're in now. Then learn about the flora and fauna of North Dakota with Chuck Lura's Natural North Dakota Newsletter. We've got e-newsletters previewing programs on radio and TV as well. Sign up and read all about it at prairiepublic.org.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. We hope you can join us again tomorrow for an important discussion about dementia and Alzheimer's. There is help here in North Dakota for families that are impacted, and we'll have a conversation with Joan Danks. She's North Dakota's Program Director for the Alzheimer's Association. That's tomorrow, right here on Main Street, and we hope you'll be with us.